Welcome to The B-Word, a podcast about humans, organisations, behaviour. I'm your host, James Healy. In the Netflix movie Don't Look Up, two astrophysics professors, played brilliantly by Leonardo DiCaprio and Jennifer Lawrence, attempt to warn the world of the impending arrival of a planet-destroying comet. It's a message that's largely ignored by a populace more interested in celebrity tittle-tattle and the seductive charms of social media. The film is a tragicomic allegory for climate change and the repeated failure of well-intentioned attempts to change our behaviour by educating and raising awareness. It's simultaneously hilarious and massively depressing, but it says much about the usual approach to behaviour change. We assume that if we educate people, make them aware of the consequences of their actions, they'll change their behavior. But is there a human being alive who's unaware of the concept of climate change? Whether or not they believe it or choose to act on their awareness, surely no one is unaware. Yet so many efforts to counter the threat of climate change and to address many other issues besides come down to raising awareness, despite the vast evidence in front of all of us that this approach simply isn't working. Why do we so often persist with failed approaches to so many problems? How can behavioral science come up with better solutions for climate change and for many other issues? My guest today is Christina Gravett, an assistant professor in behavioral economics at the University of Copenhagen. She's been researching decision-making for over 10 years, collaborating with local and national governments, nonprofits, and private companies to run large-scale randomized control trials, and publishing her work in top academic and policy journals. She's an elected board member of the Society for the Advancement of Behavioral Science. Christina is a keynote speaker and workshop leader on nudging for behavior change, and is also the co-founder of Impactually, one of Sweden's first behavioral insights consultancies. Morning, Christina.
Welcome. Hi, James.
Thanks for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
So I'm a big fan of your TED Talk, as I think I've told you before. Let's start by talking about that. What exactly is evidence-based policy?
Well, when I thought about the TED Talk, I think something that has always interested me, bothered me when working with organizations, when working with the public sector, is that so many times, people get together and they brainstorm some great idea, and then they implement that because somehow to them it made intuitive sense, and maybe they read something or they've seen something online or they had these good ideas, and then they implement this idea and then they think it should work. But what I would like to talk about is a particular example where I think this becomes quite evident that this can be also problematic if that's the way we do this. For example, I'm sure that every listener here has seen a billboard that said something like, don't text and drive, or pay attention on the road. So sometimes there's a cute little kid that looks really sad because they lost their parent, or sometimes you see a corpse, or sometimes you see some like very creative way of a smashed phone. And all these different types of campaigns are probably come up with people, either a fancy marketing agency or just a local traffic and safety committee. And the idea behind it is good, right? It's this idea, probably people get together and they say, okay, we need to come up with something novel, something like that's really going to shock people and that's going to make them drive more carefully. And then they brainstorm and they have all these good ideas and they finally come up with an idea. Maybe they even test it on a few people and say, if you would see this billboard, would you then drive more carefully? And people would say, yeah, that's really shocking. I've never seen this before. And then they implement the billboard and maybe say they spend $100,000 on this campaign. And then I think they've really done something to change behavior. But what research has now shown, like in a study, I think it was published last year, a year ago, they actually evaluated the effect of these billboards on driving behavior. And they found that this actually led to more traffic deaths than it did before. So even though this was really a great idea and people put a lot of effort into designing this, we actually see that it had this negative effect. And unfortunately, this is something that we see quite a lot. So if we think about how organizations or how governments design policies, it is often this structure of seeing a problem and then trying to come up with a good solution, maybe workshopping it or reading about it, and then implementing it. But when it comes to evidence-based policy or evidence-based solutions, we should first think about, does it actually change behavior? And there's, of course, different ways to do this. And what I talk about in the TED Talk is that we should do randomized controlled trials so that we should actually test different versions of our ideas, see if they actually change behavior, and then implement this as policy or as an intervention. And not as maybe many economists do, and this is what a lot of my colleagues do, right? They maybe look at a policy that was implemented in the 70s and they now analyze whether that had a positive or negative effect on something. And we can, of course, still learn from that, but that is often then a retrospective way of doing it or not doing it at all and just thinking that this had an effect.
So that makes perfect sense in theory. But I guess when I think about experiments, surely that's difficult or expensive for organizations to do, for governments to do. We just want an answer now. Can't we just get on and do what we think is going to work?
Yeah, I think you're right. I think the reason why this is often done is because most organizations or also governments are quite impatient, right? They see a problem and they want a solution now. And maybe they have some money available to do something now, or they just want a fast result. But then the problem is, if we don't know whether this result or whether this intervention has an effect, we might actually be doing something worse than before. So to the cost question, I think it varies. So in many cases where I worked with organizations, it's often possible to use the data that's maybe anyway being collected, but then to add this layer of randomization or to testing something. So let's say one study I worked with, we were looking at, can we get more people to use public transport? And what the area in Sweden had been doing for many, many years was to, every time a person moved to a new apartment, they would get a free 2-week travel card. So it said, hi, welcome to the neighborhood. You can travel for free with public transport for 2 weeks. Go ahead. And they gave them these cards. So they were anyway sending out these cards every time somebody moved. Every month there was a new campaign for several years. But they'd never tried really anything different. Maybe they updated what it looked like for a while, but they never actually evaluated, did this actually have an effect on public transport usage? So what we suggested then, what we did, was that we randomly sent out different versions of these flyers. So it was 2-week travel period or a whole month's travel period or with different types of nudges, and then to see whether that would have an effect. In terms of cost, what you just said, I mean, it costs the same, because all we had to do was print slightly different flyers or maybe increase the travel period a bit on one card. But if you're a travel agency, if people travel a bit more for free, it doesn't make a big difference on the bottom line, actually, if that leads them to travel more by public transport in the long run. So what we found here is that if we sent them a whole month's travel card, they were actually significantly more likely to take up the card and travel with it, and even travel with it 8 months later, which then also increased the revenue of the company. So if they, at an earlier point, would have tested this, is it 2 months, is it a whole month, is it 2 weeks or a whole month, they might have gotten this result at an earlier point. And yeah, like I said, here, for example, there was really no difference in cost. It was exactly the same from testing it or not testing it.
So it sounds like there are ways of testing things more cheaply. Not everything has to be a full randomized controlled trial. I think the message is fairly clear. It's we need to be a bit more humble and we need to test and iterate. Is that a fair reflection?
Exactly. And I think often, right, we can use what we already have to test. So even this billboard example I had before was the don't text and drive. Maybe if you had 3 different versions and put them in different places and then maybe look at, does this have an effect on road accidents, maybe using some data from before and from after. Again, as you say, this is maybe not a perfectly randomized controlled trial, but it can give us a bit of more information what idea has is the best to implement. I think often working with organizations or also in the public sector, we often try to come up with the best idea and then implement that. And I think maybe being a bit more humble and saying, okay, we have 3-4 ideas that all seem pretty reasonable and might be good, and then putting those out there maybe for a short while, testing that, evaluating that, is going to give us much better insights rather than thinking we need to come up with that perfect idea from the drawing board and then implement that, and then that's going to be great. because I think even if we look at some of the best organizations in the world that work with behavioral science, behavioral insights team in the UK, even they have a lot of studies where they show that their preferred idea wasn't actually the one that worked best, but maybe the third or the second best idea from the brainstorming session was the one that actually had the biggest impact on behavior.
So I like that. And I think now let's take that concept of testing and learning, of being humble and experimenting, and let's talk about how we apply that in some more real world contexts. Now, I know that you've done some really interesting work in health, but particularly recently, you've really been focusing on sustainability and the environment. Why do we need behavioral science for sustainability? Surely the solution to this is to raise awareness, make people understand the impact of their behaviors, the impact on the climate, impact on the environment. And once they're aware and they understand, they'll change their behavior, no?
Exactly. That's what my economist colleagues would say, right? So the traditional economic thinking, or maybe traditionally psychological thinking. So we give people new information, they update with that information, and then they should change behavior because they now know that what they're doing is wrong, or that it has particular types of costs. And obviously, this is an important first step, because if people don't understand why it's important to change, if they don't understand that climate change is real and that we need to do something about it, then also behavior change is not going to happen. But as you were already alluding to, it's not going to be enough, right? So we see so many times that people have the awareness now, and they have the information, they have the understanding of what they should do differently, but then we don't see them changing their behavior. So I think we see this a lot in surveys, right? If people are asked, do you think it's important to protect the climate? Are you interested in changing your habits to reduce your climate impact? Most people will now say yes, and even if it's just what they think they should say, but at least they understand that this is the answer they should give to that type of question, except for a small group of people. If you ask them how much meat they consume, they would say, oh, I only eat organic meat and only on the weekend, and it's very seldom, and I take care to buy it at a good butcher and only that, and I know it's bad, but I still want to do it. But then we see that this often doesn't carry through to their actual behavior. And then the question is, of course, is it that they're lying in all these surveys? Everybody is just like 80% of the population says they know about climate change or says they want to change, but truly they don't want to? Or is it that they truly want to change, but that the situations and the environment is still set up in a way that makes this difficult? That in the moment, we forget that we're planning to eat more plant-based, or that we're planning to take the bicycle more to work, but then it rains and, I don't know, we need to take the kids to school and, it's just a little bit easier to take the car. Or with so many other choices, we want to take reusable bags to the supermarket, but we end up standing there in the queue and then we realize that we forgot them at home. And well, now again, we have to buy some plastic bags. So all these small type of situations that get in the way of carrying through our like awareness and our good intentions to our behavior. And that's really, I think, where behavioral science is the most useful, not to convince people that they should change, but to help those people change that are already convinced that they want to change.
It's funny you cite that example of leaving the bags at home or in the car. I do that on a fairly regular basis. I won't say once a week. It's probably more like once every 2 weeks, but that one certainly resonates with me, and I'm sure will resonate with some of our listeners as well. Now, sustainability, climate change, the environment, however we want to term this, they're huge topics, huge, huge challenges. Which particular areas or which particular sub-problems within those broader envelopes of problems do you think are most suitable or most amenable to a behavioral science approach?
So one might think that we need to have a big impact, and that's to get climate change to change, right? We need to move behavior really on a large scale. And obviously there's been a lot of discussions now in the area that we need also structural change, or maybe we need to incentivize firms differently, or that we need to think about how to maybe develop a new train line through the US so people don't have to fly. And of course these are important measures, and these are going to have a big effect on climate change and on that. But when it comes to using behavioral science, this is really about consumers and about individual people. So especially when we think about things like nudging, this is a tool for individual people, because what we're trying to do is to address biases, address momentarily inattention, address maybe social norms that people feel. So this is not a tool to nudge a whole organization with, but it's only for individual people within the organization. But to have the largest impact here, I would usually recommend choosing areas where a lot of people do something very often. And those are areas of, for example, food consumption. We all have to eat, and we all eat usually at least 3 times per day. Or travel to work, so commuting behavior or kind of everyday travel, maybe less than that one flight you're taking to Bali once per year. Maybe there's something to do here as well if we think about everybody flying. But then again, there's actually not such a large part of the population that takes these very long distance flights. So maybe then individual business travel or something, short distance flights might be more important to think about, to change. Or littering behavior or weight, any type of waste sorting or food waste is a huge issue that I think has not seen that much research yet. It's quite difficult to study. So the best thing also for organizations internally is to think about, what do we see, what type of behavior do we see very often, and what really is a lot of people acting on this way, and not trying to get at the small or seldom behaviors, because there it's a lot of effort to design a good intervention and it might actually have a small effect. You also know this, right? We need to be honest when it comes to nudging behavioral interventions. Effect sizes are maybe 10%, right? If we're doing it well, so something between 2 and 10%, unless we take a really good default effect, then it can be higher. But those things can be very meaningful, but they are meaningful if it really scales up to a large group of people.
I think all of that makes perfect sense. And I think we'll come back a bit later to some of the practical ways that organizations and indeed individuals can use these kinds of techniques. I guess I'm keen to understand where behavioral interventions, you know, as you say, targeted at individuals, fit in with more traditional sort of economic and regulatory interventions in this space around sustainability.
Most economists, and I'm one of them, would argue that we need to have a carbon tax at some point on, so that we can really price in the externalities of what our behavior is costing the world, or at least take away the subsidies. So make meat cost what it actually costs to produce, and also its effect on the climate. Same for fossil fuels and these types of things, building materials, concrete, those types of things, and subsidize the things that are good. If you have solar panels on your roof, or if you are consuming more plant-based foods or more local foods, then this is something that potentially should be rewarded. So I think here a price mechanism does make sense. But the problem we see with sometimes these price mechanisms, and there's some like wonderful work by colleagues on this, is showing that, well, it's quite hard to implement a tax, because you also need to calculate what are the externalities, what is the right level. So there's been a nice paper recently asking experts on how high should a CO2 tax, for example, be. And between a couple of cents per ton to thousands of dollars per ton, there's a lot of different opinions on what's the right price, because depending on how you calculate these externalities, so the effect on the climate, you and how you calculate the discount rate, you're going to get very different estimates. But if you now want to implement this in policy, you need to decide on a price. You need to say it costs $2 per ton, or you need to have some type of price mechanism on the market that then the price results from. So this is actually pretty difficult to implement. So what we now recently argued in a paper is say, well, maybe some behavioral interventions can lead up to this, or can help while we're still figuring out what's the perfect way to tax different things. There's a very extensive paper on meat tax, for example. How would we calculate that? So what exactly is the externality? We know it's there and we know it has an effect, but where do you start? Is it from the farm, or is it just like the piece of meat that you actually buy, or is it the whole pig and the things you have to throw away? So there's many ways of how you need to consider this. So I think that's definitely something where behavioral science can also be a complement while we figure this out, even though I think it's super important. And then second of all, also taxes and regulatory things, for example, saying maybe we shouldn't have any meat on the menu, or people just can't park their cars anymore at their workplace, so they have to take public transport or take a bike or something. This is often difficult to push through politically, but it also might lead to some problems that, but what if you're somebody's handicapped and they need to take a car? So if we close down all the roads in the city, then so people take more bikes, what if they can't do it? And so it leads to a lot of these challenges. And the nice thing about nudging in behavioral science is often that it changes the behavior of those who are able to change and who are willing to change, but without really pushing those who cannot change or really do not want to change or have good reason not to change. So I think that's also something where we can move a lot of people, but without having these maybe extreme cases and needing to debate those. So I think that's really like generally a question about these different policy instruments, regulations, taxes, and behavioral interventions. And then in addition to that, and this we've recently discussed in a paper, we might want to think about, but if we do have a carbon tax, maybe we can make it more salient by using behavioral science in a clever way. So there's a great paper by Rush Chetty and an old paper showing that most people don't really realize a tax when they look at a particular price. So, but then the problem could be if the price of meat goes up, people might perceive it as a luxury good. So they might think that, eating meat, that's for wealthy people, that's very fancy. So it might actually increase demand compared to decreasing it. If we don't tell people, it's more expensive because there is that effect on the climate, and that's why it has a tax, and that's why you should be buying less of it, not more. So that's one thing. Another example is harnessing like climate concerns, because the problem can sometimes be with taxes. If you're relatively wealthy, the effect of the tax is going to be lower for you of such a consumption tax, because for you, if you pay a couple of cents more for the meat or for a congestion tax for driving into the city, you might actually be happy about it. You might be willing to pay a little bit more so to have less people on the street, because you get to work faster, because some people cannot afford anymore to drive into the city. I know this was a big thing in Brazil at some point, that a lot of the wealthy people were very much pro congestion charge, because it would mean that many people couldn't afford anymore to go into city and it would be better for them. So of course, that's not what we want. We don't want these distributional problems that tax can sometimes create. So here, harnessing behavioral science, for example, social norms. In Sweden, they had this idea of flugskam, so making people feel ashamed for flying. That is something that's actually going to hit those higher earners more probably than the ones who anyway don't fly that much or don't fly on jet setting to south of France three times a year. So that might be some way to kind of even out these distributional problems we get if we only have a tax, and then we can try to get other people in a different way using behavioral science.
Yeah, it's interesting. I hadn't heard the Brazil example before, but I had heard, and I'm sure you've heard this one, the relatively famous story. I don't know whether it was a formal study or not, but from Israel around childcare. And particular daycare centers introduced essentially a penalty fee if you were more than, I think it was 15 minutes late to pick up your child. And they did this out of sheer frustration that people were, certain parents were being late to pick up their kids repeatedly. And the intention, of course, was that by putting a price on it, it would deter people from doing it. And of course, what happened? Completely the opposite. As soon as you put a price on it, it's seen as, if I pay the, the $15 or whatever it was, I can get an extra half hour. So completely the opposite effect to what was intended. And again, I think it's a great example of where we started this conversation. Sometimes you have to try these things out and test them, because the best intentioned interventions don't always work the way that we expect. Humans are complicated and unpredictable.
Exactly.
That said, how do you think organizations, first of all, and we'll come on to individuals in a moment, but what are some ways that organizations can use behavioral science to advance their sustainability agendas? We've talked about governments, we've talked about society, but at an organizational level, how can behavioral science help with the sustainability agenda?
So I think whether it's an organization or a government or a society in general, I think it's always the same process, right? So you want to think about what are meaningful behaviors that we would want to change that would make actually a difference in the bottom line. And this can be very different for different types of organizations. Do they have people that travel a lot for work? Maybe they have a car park. Is that something that you want to look at? Or is there, food consumption obviously is always a topic because everybody eats, but it might also be particular going more paperless or heating the offices differently. And now here in Denmark, we had the situation that now for the winter, all the heaters were put down to 19 degrees Celsius to just keep it that way. It's not a behavioral intervention, it's a very strict mandate. So they just technically changed all the heaters so we would use less energy. But I think here, the first step really for every organization is to think about, okay, where do we want to change? So what type of behavior might have an impact on our climate goals, on our sustainability agenda, and then start with that. And then the next question is this really a behavioral problem? So in this case, you could say, right, let's say when it comes to printing, well, if you have to, I come from Germany, and there are a lot of stuff is still printed out and put into a folder. So of course, if that's the structure, if you still need to print things and then put them somewhere or send them via real mail with a real stamp, then it's not a behavioral problem, then it's a structural problem. You just need to think about, can we implement a technological solution to sign documents so that we don't actually need to send the paper with the stamp and the signature? So then nudging or behavioral science doesn't make any sense because this is a practical structural problem. Or if you only have paper cups in the offices and there are no reusable cups or ceramic cups, well, then you can't tell people that they need to create less waste because if they want to have coffee, then you need to fix that. So the second step is really to think about, well, we have maybe the reusable cups, but people aren't using them. So why is this happening? What is it about this? So what is their behavior that they could keep using the plastic or the paper cups and throwing them in the trash? Or we have a great recycling system, but people aren't recycling. Like all the trash still goes into that one big bin in the kitchen and it doesn't actually go into the paper or into the plastic one. And those are then the areas where behavioral science makes sense because then you want to think about why is this happening? And is this something about attention or is it something about social norms or is it something about just it's not being very salient or that's just like the path of least resistance. It's just laziness and it's just the easiest to put everything there because people don't understand the sorting system, even though they got 5 emails about this every couple of months explaining how it works. But maybe it's not on the trash can of how you should sort it. And that's maybe how people still end up throwing everything in one bin. So that's then really the next step. And then as we talked about, I would say, well, how can we then test our hypotheses? Because I might come up with the idea that, yeah, they're still using the paper cups because they don't care about the climate and this is what they want to do and they're just lazy. Yeah, but maybe it's the dishwasher is always, nobody turns it on in the evening and that's why the reusable cups are never clean in the morning. So that's why people use the paper cups. Okay, so then maybe in one intervention would be determine one person who in the evening is in charge of turning on the dishwasher so that they're washed in the morning. That might be a fairly easy fix. It's not glamorous or it's not a amazing brainstorming marketing campaign-y thing. It's just that you need to have one person's going to press that button before they leave the office so you have clean cups in the morning. And then see if that has an effect. And if it does, great. If that was not the problem, well, then we might need to do something else. So I think that's really the same process, whether you're an organization or you're a government. And sometimes it's larger scaled, but defined the behavior that is problematic, figure out if it's actually a behavioral problem or if it's a structural problem, come up with a couple of good ideas, and then test which of these ideas is going to have an effect.
I love that. One of the things I often talk to clients about is that first part. As you said earlier, humans tend to be impatient. We want to get straight to solution mode. I'm often asked, what's the intervention? What's the nudge that can fix this? And the response, of course, is, well, first of all, we need to identify the behavior. And actually, what we found in organizations, at least, is that's often the hardest part, teasing out from the overall problem statement or what people think the problem is, what is actually the behavioral part of this? What is the behavior that we need to change?
Mm. And then also maybe staying with the what is the barrier to it? So when I do workshops with organizations, it's often that I actually force them. So we do the workshop in steps and say, and I go around and say, do not talk about solutions. And I go to each group and say, oh, this sounded like a solution. Stop talking about that. And that's really the biggest thing in these workshops, that people are like, once you have a behavioral problem, they're like, oh, maybe you could do this. Maybe you could do a sign. I have an idea. I once saw this on this paper, or saw this example, or this would be, have you tried doing this? And then, yeah, it's really, and I tell them to tell each other and to stop each other when they come up with anything that sounds like a solution. Say, no, we first need to figure out why is there this problem in the first place? And then we can move on to the solution and map that on. And I think you're completely right. I think that's often where organizations get it wrong. Maybe they're solving the wrong problem. That's also a big thing. But then once they have a particular problem, they could try to come up with solutions immediately. And I think that's maybe where the academics come in a bit, right? Because the biggest thing we do in our everyday work is to try to ask, why is this problem happening? And then maybe we don't care about solutions so much, but actually the why. And I think that's also where academics and more practitioners, something, can work together really well, because yeah, most people who work in industry or organizations are very good at the solution part. And then maybe academics are a bit better at asking the why is this a problem in the first place part. And then bringing these two parts together can then actually be very helpful when designing behavioral interventions.
No, it's a great point. Often something that we see when we're digging into the barriers is the instinctive response, the first response from people as to what they think the barrier is absolutely not the barrier. You've got to go 3, 4, 5 steps beyond that. And some funny examples, I mean, most people for most behaviors in most organizations will default to one of two responses. The barrier is the system. The system's rubbish. The system doesn't let me do what I want to do. That, you know, we need a new system. Or my boss is an idiot. My boss doesn't want me to do this. Or my boss doesn't value this. And of course, when you dig into it, what you find is, well, it's not that the system's rubbish. It's that the system is in place to support a particular process, which isn't the right process, or it's not the current process. Your boss isn't an idiot, usually. Sometimes they might be. But usually your boss is behaving in a particular way because they've got some KPIs or some incentives that you're maybe not aware of. They've got some political battle going on with the other department over here. There's always something underlying. So you've got to keep digging deeper. You've got to, I think it's a Rory Sutherland quote, you've got to try and understand the real why. And the real why is not the same as the surface why.
Yeah, so I think here it also helps as a practical tip. So what I do in workshops, for example, is to look at different types of biases or reasons that are possible, and then actually force yourself or force your group to go through of them and say, okay, is it the boss? Is it the laziness? Is it the other people? Is it social norms? Is it something about the system? And that you then actually have to force yourself. And with some things, like you say, it's easy to say, okay, this is definitely not it here. And then maybe it's this one. But I think every single time I've done this, yes, people will come up with a few ideas, or was maybe the third or fourth thing to be the thing that actually matters. So I think forcing yourself to spend more time on that, and maybe actually setting a clock or spending a whole day on this, can be super helpful before actually trying to do any type of intervention.
So we're getting into practical tips, and I know we've talked a lot about organizations. Let's talk a little bit about individuals now. So what are some of the behavioral science techniques? And yes, I'm going straight to interventions here. What are some of the behavioral science techniques that you'd recommend for individuals to change behavior? Perhaps we start with sustainability and maybe talk more broadly. I'm sure everyone listening to this has at least one behavioral challenge they'd like to address in their own lives. What are some of the things they can take away?
Yeah, so I think for individuals, if they want to nudge themselves or change their own behavior, I think, or generally, often a big thing is about attention at the right moment. So getting the right reminders at the right point of time. And here, of course, smartphones can be amazing because they can help us remember things. So if you need to take medication, or if you need to drink more water, or if you want to stand up from your desk in the middle of the day to take a couple of steps, or all these different things that you might want. But here, and this is some research I've also worked on, is that we might also set up too many reminders or set them up at the wrong point of time. So also sending other people emails or reminding them about something. A reminder only makes sense if you can act on it at that very moment. So I think what can be very helpful is to also for yourself think about, let's say I want to remember to send somebody a birthday greeting or something, a small thing. It's not life changing, but if I do this in the middle, if I get a notification in the middle of a meeting, of course, I'm not going to act on it at that point. Or if I want to remember to take the bags out of the car, right? It's only helpful if I have that reminder when I'm getting out of the car or maybe before I get into the car, so I put them in the right place. So these reminders can, of course, be digital, but they can also be practical. Where do I place? Maybe if you place the shopping bags next to you on the driver's seat or on the passenger seat, you're more likely to remember them when you get out of the car, because then you're already thinking about what you want to buy or what you want to do afterwards. So I think that's something that if you realize that you often forget to do things or you want to change behavior differently or put the, now I'm taking a lot of walks recently. I just had a baby, so we're taking a lot of walks. And of course, it's easy to buy a coffee at a coffee shop when I'm out and it's nice weather and I want a coffee. But I'm trying to take more coffee from home because we have an amazing coffee machine and that's also good and also cheaper. So putting the reusable cup next to the coffee machine so that I remember when I'm hectically trying to get out of the house with an 8-week-old that I can quickly make myself a coffee there and not think about it when I'm already out of the house or these types of things. So I think by thinking through your day and thinking about how where to strategically place maybe things or reminders or also set them up on the phone can be super helpful if you want to if you want to change. So I think that's like one of the biggest things because it's often not about that we don't know how to do things or we don't want to do them, but we don't think about them at the right point of time. So I think that's the biggest thing I think we individuals can change. And or maybe a second thing, reminders I think a good one, but then a second one is also, are there particular frictions that you have that prevent you from doing something? So for example, when it comes to waste sorting, once you've implemented that you have different bins for different bins outside, it's going to be easier to sort. So we often have the problem that it was a bit crowded in the area where we had the trash, and then it's very hard to put the newspaper in because it's already full, and then maybe we put it on the side, but that's also annoying. So then you just end putting up in the general bin. So maybe going to a big box store and getting a nice trash sorting system, sorting it once and for all is going to make it easier. Or having the mixer and having the whatever different types of ingredients that you want to put for a healthy smoothie in the morning in the right place is going to also then make it easier to do it in the morning. So attention is one thing. And the other thing is small frictions that, somehow you keep on stumbling over. Are there some ways of how to reduce that friction so it makes it easier to do that behavior? I don't know, getting a new bicycle lock, because if you're like in Copenhagen, it's freezing in the morning and it's always frozen and you can't open the lock. Well, then you might run to the bus because you can't go inside and get the oil in order to fix your lock. Maybe by buying a better lock, and that's more of a systematic problem, that might also then help you take the bike in the morning if it's cold.
So I love these examples, and I particularly love that you picked on my shopping bag problem. I've taken notes on the practical solution to this, which is, in fact, put the bags on the seat of the car. There we go. Who knew? I think there's lots of practical tips for our listeners, and I think that timely reminders is really, really key. As you say, our phones are wonderfully designed to give us timely reminders of all of these things that we don't really need. If we can turn that around and use them to remind us of things that we do need, that would be beneficial. And then the reducing the frictions piece. I think regular listeners will have heard me talk about this before, but it is amazing the extent to which seemingly minor frictions or minor inconveniences can stop us doing things that we, on the surface, really, really want to do. So I think removing friction is a key step.
And maybe another just a small tip with the phone. If we have too many reminders, that's also, of course, a problem. So, for example, you can schedule notifications at particular times in the day. So what I do is that all the Instagram, Twitter, news, all these types of things that I don't need to be constantly reminded about, that they come maybe just every hour, or maybe for me they come twice a day. so that I also sort out what are important reminders that I want to have and what are the ones that are distracting from other thoughts. And I think that's also, it takes a bit of time to set up on the phone, but I think most phones can do it and think about, can I maybe group some of the reminders that I don't need to have every 5 minutes popping up on the phone so that I can pay attention to the ones that I want to pay attention to. And so I think that's also it, like reducing information or attention in areas where I don't need it so that I'm not distracted from what I actually want to do.
I think that's a great point. And I think most people in 2023 would have to admit that one of their behavioral challenges is probably using their phone too much. So anything that you can do to use the phone to help you use the phone less, I think is beneficial, because I personally find it amazing that we've moved in the space of about 25-30 years from a world where no one had a mobile phone to a world where everyone spends 4, 5, 6, 7 hours a day glued to these things. It's faintly terrifying. Thank you, Christina. I could talk to you all night about this stuff, but I will allow you to return to your day. Thank you for joining us. I'm sure our listeners really enjoyed that.
Thank you so much for having me. It was fun.
I hope you enjoyed listening to that as much as we enjoyed recording it. Christina's perspective on the benefit of experiments is really simple but powerful. As humans, we tend to conflate confidence and certainty with expertise, but we need to be humble enough to accept we don't always know what's going to work. Lots of organizations pay lip service to concepts like test and learn, fail fast, agile. But how often does your organization actually run an experiment to figure out what really works in your context? It's an approach that would benefit almost every problem, large or small, but it would certainly benefit sustainability. For too long, we've assumed that raising awareness changes behavior. If there's one key lesson here, it's that raising awareness isn't enough. If it were, the world wouldn't be facing a climate emergency, a biodiversity crisis, and an ever-growing mountain of plastic. For sure, these complex structural problems have complex structural solutions, but there's certainly a role for simple behavioral interventions. As Nobel laureate Richard Thaler puts it, we can't solve climate change with nudging, but we can't solve climate change without nudging. Try it and see if it works. You've been listening to The B Word, a podcast produced by Izzy Rackage and presented by me, James Healy.